Before he left the White House yesterday for the Alamo, the president condemned last week's violence at the Capitol while referring to his speech that preceded it as totally appropriate. In his first public statement since being banned from Twitter, President Trump told reporters that the social media sites refusing him their service have made, in his words, a catastrophic mistake. Social media companies say for their part that the president's comments threaten to incite violence. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Twitter announced on Monday that they've suspended more than 70,000 conspiracy-laced accounts since Trump extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol. Jason Joyce from the Capital Times points out that former state assemblyman Adam Jarkow's account appears to be among them. So are we any safer now? Having just witnessed how conspiracies proliferated online can turn downright deadly on the ground? Be interested in hearing from you answering that question at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Also joining us to tackle these questions this morning, our guest Ian Rosenberg, who's legal counsel for ABC News and the professor of media law at Brooklyn College. His most recent book is called The Fight for Free Speech, 10 Cases That Define Our First Amendment Freedoms. Ian, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Also joining us, Karen Greenberg is a historian, professor, and author. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, an international studies fellow at New America, and she hosts the Vital Interest podcast. Karen, good to speak with you again.
Very nice to be here.
And let's start with what's happening right now on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. Potentially for the very first time in U.S. history, a president could be impeached for the second time. I'll start with you, Karen. The president facing another impeachment. What led up to this moment?
Oh, goodness. You know, I think the immediate thing that led us to this moment were the events of last week, of January 6th, and the claims on all sides of the aisle that this was basically an attempt at insurrection. And so incitement to violence is very much what is at stake here. But it's a much bigger issue than that, because the presidency has been so abused by this president that I think there's a strong sense that a message has to be sent, perhaps with more than just, you know, a second impeachment, that this needs to be rebuked and that the president needs to be held accountable in all the ways possible.
But the president denounced the violence yesterday that took place at the U.S. Capitol this week and referred to the impeachment proceedings as a witch hunt. So where, in terms of culpability, where do politicians, specific and in general, would you say, Karen, stand in terms of the responsibility for what transpired in our nation's capital?
Oh, my goodness. That's a very good question, and one that I think won't be answered by those politicians until, you know, and policymakers in the present, but perhaps in the future. I think what you're suggesting now is, you know, when do you get alarmist about a president who's exceeded his constitutional powers, abetted by chief leaders in his administration? And the answer is earlier than now. And I think there is a lot of self-reflection that needs to go on and some accountability across the board. I think this absence of self-doubt and of reviewing policymakers' behavior in terms of presidents goes well back before Trump. And so what you're suggesting is actually very important, but I don't think something that will happen anytime soon.
Ian Rosenberg, with impeachment proceedings now underway on the U.S. House floor for the second time for this president, can you give us some idea of the cases for and against in the waning days of this administration impeachment proceedings?
Well, from a free speech perspective, I think that the key issue is incitement. We have to remember that advocacy of illegal action is protected by the First Amendment until it becomes incitement. And the relevant test is Brandenburg, Supreme Court case, which tells us that speech advocating illegal action is protected until the moment it is directed to and likely to cause imminent physical harm. And I think there is a strong argument to be made that the president's speech to the what can be called protesters, who then became a violent mob, was in fact incitement. Even though it may have been coded language, it was in my opinion, directed to and, in fact, did cause imminent physical harm.
So we're looking, Ian, at the gray area between free speech and hate speech. We're not actually talking about that. We're talking about where the speech rises to the level of incitement?
Correct. And, in fact, there's a common misconception that hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment, but it is under the American interpretation of hate speech law. So we are, in fact, talking about incitement. Advocacy of a legal action is protected, but directing people to cause violence is not.
So if I were to shout fire in a crowded theater when there was no fire and people were to be hurt in the effort to exit the building, does that rise to incitement?
Well, that is one of my favorite phrases to try and correct. The actual comes out of the Abrams case, which led to our modern incitement law, which is discussed in the first chapter of my book. It is actually to cry fire falsely in a crowded theater and to cause a panic. So I just always want to make sure that people understand, because speech is always restricted as if people could say, well, you can't cry fire in a crowded theater. But in fact, you should be crying fire in a crowded theater if the building is on fire or even if you smell smoke. So you cannot cry fire in a crowded theater falsely and cause a panic. That's not what's at issue here. What's at issue here, as you're starting to point out, is that did Trump's speech to the protesters cross a line into incitement?
Well, didn't we see thousands of people last week in our nation's capital who thought there was smoke and thought there was fire, and that was the reason they took to the Capitol, that the insurrection began?
And that's why they were absolutely within their rights, much as I might disagree with them, to protest the election, to support President Trump, to express their views, whether they be hateful or not. But what they do not have a right to do is to then storm the Capitol building and cause violence. It bears stating clearly that there is no First Amendment protections for trespass. There are no First Amendment protections for property damage. And of course, there are no First Amendment protections for violence.
Ian Rosenberg is an expert on media law and free speech rights. Also joining us, Karen Greenberg, expert on national security, terrorism, and civil liberties. And Karen, the vice president sent a letter to the House Speaker last night saying that he would not invoke the 25th Amendment to remove the president from office, saying it would not be in the best interest of the nation. With impeachment proceedings underway, with the 25th Amendment off the table, at least at this point from the vice president, what other consequences could the president face, if any?
The consequences that you wanted him to face with the 25th Amendment had to do with him, among other things, not being able to ever hold office again. And so that's actually, you know, an important part of this. And so I think, you know, we need to think about that going forward. I think the other option would have been for the president to resign, and many people have asked for him to resign. The consequences of impeachment, should it go forward, are that there could be a trial in the Senate, and that could happen, by the way, after he leaves the presidency. And that's actually a very important thing to do in terms of his not being able to have a career afterwards, in terms of his not being able to have the base that he wanted to have. I think that's a very important moment in terms of Republican buy-in. And so I do think impeachment's going to go forward. I think there's a sense that this will happen. I think that the question of a trial in the Senate is a question of timing. And I'm not sure that's been determined yet. There are people on both sides of the conversation, some who think this should be done as rapidly as possible, and others who think it should be done deliberatively and over time so that the incoming administration can turn to more important matters. And so, the consequences basically are what will happen to Trump going forward in terms of public life. And then, of course, there are all the other cases that are going forward in the courts themselves, ones that are reported to be coming down the pike and ones that already exist. So, for example, in New York with Cy Vance. And so there are many consequences, and this president could be tied up in legal proceedings beyond impeachment, well beyond his presidency.
Not just Cy Vance in New York City, but also the New York State Attorney General, Tish James,
Tish James.
investigations open. Are there Republicans in this second round impeachment proceedings? Are there Republicans that appear to be more inclined to support it?
Oh, yeah. There's been, I mean, every hour you hear either on, you know, in a rumor or in an actual statement, including what McConnell said last night, Mitch McConnell, in terms of all of a sudden being reported to support the validity of the impeachment and the importance of the impeachment. And I think, as you've seen, there's kind of a peeling away of leaders and House members and senators of just peeling away of, well, I was up to Trump. I was with Trump up to this point, but now I'm no longer with him. And you've kind of seen that coming. You saw it with Lindsey Graham's speech to the Senate on January 6th. And that was actually an important moment. You've seen it with Ted Cruz. You see a little less. But these are moments that people are watching. And these people have their own constituencies. And they speak to the base that Trump speaks to. And so the more they weigh in, the more it peels off from his base. Not to mention, to Ian's point, overstepping the bounds of the First Amendment, causing violence, ransacking the Capitol, was a deterrent moment for many, both representatives and the country at large, or at least that's what many of us think.
Karen Greenberg is a historian, professor, and author. She's also the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School and hosts the Vital Interest podcast. She's joined by Ian Rosenberg, legal counsel for ABC News, the fight for free speech, professor of media law at Brooklyn College, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Where are we going from here and what is next? Be interested to hear what you think and what you have planned when we continue. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So Amazon suspended its website hosting service for Parler, which is was a relatively new social media network catering to political conservatives. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and Amazon's explanation was not dissimilar to Twitter's reasons for banning the president. Calls for violence violated the company's terms of service, not to mention the better angels of our nature. If the accounts are banned and the networks get disconnected, are the threats to our democratic process gone? So then, where have they gone? 1-800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest, Ian Rosenberg, legal counsel for ABC News, and Karen Greenberg. She is the director from the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. Ian, I want to go to you here about claims that the president's First Amendment rights are being infringed upon by the social media networks like Twitter and many others who have declined to rebroadcast him. I think most recently, YouTube, within the last day, has pulled down a video of his and prevented the president from posting anything else on YouTube for the next 7 days. Is this an infringement on the president's rights?
The answer is no. It's important to understand that all social media platforms are private entities and do not have to abide by the First Amendment. Remember, the text of the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, and that means the federal government and the states may not restrict speech in most circumstances, but private companies, like all the social media companies you mentioned, can restrict people's speech all they want. They can kick people off their platforms, they can edit content, they can refuse to take ads from people they don't want to. And in fact, these choices represent the First Amendment rights of the companies themselves. So while these restrictions or these bans on Trump may raise important social issues, they are not going to be found by the courts to be unconstitutional violations of the First Amendment. That much is clear.
So I would be very interested in how you see the president claiming that it would be a catastrophic disaster if these social networks do not allow our government official, our top government official, unfettered access to their company's channels.
Well, so there are two ways of looking at that question. As a First Amendment matter, there is no First Amendment right to be on any particular platform. And so the president is just wrong and misleading when he says that there is some type of draconian First Amendment violation going on here, although I doubt he would use the word draconian. But from a bigger perspective, yes, we do have to look at whether we want big tech companies to be limiting the amount of diversity of viewpoints we have, particularly government leaders, on the social media that we all use today for our free speech communication. But that does not mean that we need to give either the social media companies a free pass. They should be more transparent, their rules should be clearer, their policies should be explained in more detail. And at the same time, they also should be and are legally allowed to be monitoring violence and incitement to violence.
Karen Greenberg, I keep hearing about Section 230 and whatever that is, and I don't claim to understand it. So I'll ask you, can you explain why folks are saying Section 230 and what that means to me?
Yeah, well, we're about to find out what it actually means. So Section 230 is basically the section of the law that provides immunity for website publishers, for others, others who use their platform. And so it's an immunity from liability, but it also separates out the internet companies from it separates them out from just where their accountability lies, because it says they are not publishers, right? So in essence, what it's suggesting is that they don't have to go by the same rules and regulations than, let's say, the New York Times would, in terms of their fact-checking, their scrutiny, their accountability for what's, you know, on their platform. And that's really where the problem lies. And you can be sure going forward, and I'm sure Ian has some ideas about this, that 230 is going to come under scrutiny, because both the left and the right, for different reasons, are talking about reforming it and focusing on it. You know, on the one hand, should there be, more liability? On the other hand, should there be less liability? I mean, the fact is that the big tech companies have too much power. And this is what we've seen, the results of this. What can we take down? What shouldn't we take down? And the question is there a way within, First Amendment guarantees, but also within the realities of the marketplace and the usefulness of the internet and of social media, is there a way realistically to curtail this? And if there is, who should be in charge? Should there be some kind of regulatory commission above the companies? Should there be more laws? And we don't know. This is we've known for a long time as a country and a culture that this is something that has to be harnessed and paid attention to. And it's one of those examples where the conversation's gone so far, and now this is where the rubber hits the road, and we're going to have to look not just at Section 230, but the entire apparatus for regulating the internet.
So walk me through this, and I don't know whether it's Karen or Ian who's best to answer this, but I'm curious. If the president got what he wanted and was allowed to use social media networks the way he wanted, unfettered, and he was allowed to get the liability protections removed from Section 230, what would be the end result if one of his posts were considered to incite violence, as has been cited last week? What would be the end result if he were to go online and be considered to be inciting violence on a social media network under the Section 230 reforms that he would like? Who would be held responsible for those actions?
I can jump in and say that I think the look at the Section 230 issues are very important. And as Karen said, both the right and the left want reform there. However, Section 230 is not really applicable in the scenario you point out. What Section 230 does, which many people call the law that created the internet, is it enables all social media platforms to not have to screen for libel or other types of concerns the posts of their users. So if every time you posted something on Twitter, the Twitter itself had to undergo the type of review that we do at ABC News, or as Karen says, the New York Times does before they publish something, that would basically bring social media to a standstill. There's no way that all of those comments, even if you somehow only had the quote-unquote controversial comments being vetted, social media as we know it wouldn't have existed and would come to a standstill. And there's no need for Section 230 reform to either find Trump responsible for incitement or for the social media companies to deplatform Trump or other officials or other speakers as they did. Trump has really used Section 230 as a misleading lightning rod for his own personal vendetta against Twitter and social media, and only brought up the topic of reforming Section 230 once Twitter started labeling his tweets as misleading. So it's really, I think, a red herring as part of this type of discussion.
But I thought that the liability would have shifted from the individual making the comments to the forum that was hosting the comments.
Well, that could be true, but again, incitement to there would be really no legal liability, even if Trump is inciting violence. Publishing incitement to violence is not a crime under both criminal law, or would not be something that would raise some type of constitutional exception. So I see your point, but what would happen would happen well before we got into incitement issues. It would start if Section 230 liability is totally removed, as Trump has, his position has changed over time. But if it was totally removed, we would basically have all social media companies at a standstill. They would not be able to not only post incitement issues, they would have to worry about every single criticism of that somebody was posting on Twitter that may not have the type of factual basis that it would be necessary to publish it by a responsible publisher.
And the end result would be that, would Twitter exist under those rules? Would social media be able to exist under those rules?
It's hard to know how it would go forward.
Yeah.
We're speaking about hypothetical revisions to 230. There could be slight tweaking of the rules in different places, but I don't think that the problems of big tech or even social media speech are best served by delving into or reforming 230. I think there are other issues that are outside the First Amendment speech area, regulatory reform, as Karen mentioned, or antitrust reform, as many attorney generals are suing Facebook, for example.
Ian Rosenberg is the legal counsel for ABC News. Our other guest, Karen Greenberg, director of for the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. And our conversation about what's next following the riots last week at the U.S. Capitol continue with you at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The U.S. House of Representatives is debating an article of impeachment against President Trump as we speak. Wisconsin Public Radio is providing special coverage of this historic event on our NPR news and music stations, as well as online at WPR.org, and that's happening right now. Special coverage from NPR, live from Washington, D.C. Here on the Ideas Network, it's The Morning Show. And you know, one of the men accused of plotting to kidnap the Michigan governor is from Wisconsin Dells. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and Brian Higgins is facing 20 years in prison for conducting surveillance on the Michigan governor's vacation home last year and providing that information to would-be kidnappers. According to the criminal charges, social media was instrumental in organizing more than a dozen men across multiple states. These men, who organized online, allegedly met for their boots-on-the-ground training in Cambria, and they planned to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer and bring her back to Wisconsin to hold a kangaroo court and try her for treason here. So what can you impart about those we know who are operating with alternative facts, who point to the internet as evidence enough, and what would you say their beliefs have done to their lives? 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org to join the show. And our guest for the hour, Ian Rosenberg, legal counsel for ABC News, author of the book, The Fight for Free Speech, 10 Cases That Define Our First Amendment Freedoms. Karen Greenberg's a historian, professor, and author. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law and the host of the Vital Interest podcast. Let's go to the phones where Tom in Buffalo County has been waiting. Tom, good morning. You're on The Morning Show.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. My question is, what do you think is the strategy for the Democrats behind the impeachment? I don't think it's just to impeach the president. I think they may be trying to force the senators to, so to say, show their hand. Are they going to continue to support Trump, or are they going to switch over and not support Trump any longer? I mean, I'm talking about, you know, U.S. senators, those that may have voted for the overturning of the election and so on. I'm very curious about your thoughts on that.
Karen, would you like to answer that?
Well, I do think that this is a very good question. And I think that, you know, I think impeachment and all that that represents is in and of itself important. But I do think there's an issue here about who the Republican Party is. And I think part of this strategy includes making individual senators express who they are. Are they the Trump Party, or are they the more traditional Republican Party that has had so many critics of Trump, particularly over the last few weeks since the election? So I don't think it's the primary goal, but I do think it's a part of the strategic underlying goal of what it's all about. So good question.
Marian Pewaukee, you're on The Morning Show. Good morning. Mary, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am. Yeah, I definitely think it's very important to impeach him. And one thing that I saw, maybe you can verify if this is accurate with your experts, that I don't want Trump, who has taken so much from the citizens of this nation, to be able to receive another penny in pension, salary, $1 million travel. Is what I read, whether that it was a meme on Facebook, so I'm not sure.
Mary!
He's a monster.
I don't think there was a question there other than what would impeachment, if anything, do to the powers of an ex-president, Donald Trump? What recourse can they take away his travel budget or his lifetime benefits as being a president of the United States? Is any of that in the cards here?
So I think, and Ian, you know, you can pile on here, but the truth is, and I think legal experts would agree, that we don't know, because we haven't really gotten to this point before. And so what this will actually mean going forward may be a question to be worked out in the future. You know, I've had a number of people write and ask, you know, would his security detail be taken away? I can't imagine that would happen, nor would I recommend that that happen. But I do think this is something that will have to be worked out on the other side of it. But again, we're in uncharted territory.
Ian, what does it mean when Twitter, among others, ban, and now YouTube, ban what the president has to say, when social media networks like Parler are taken down by Amazon, both citing the same reasons, that they are concerned about promoting the incitement of violence? Does that mean that we are limiting the problem, that we are controlling or containing the problem, or does that mean that we are playing a dangerous game of whack-a-mole, and we're just trying to figure out where this extremism rears its head next?
Well, that's the key question. So again, from a First Amendment perspective, there is absolutely nothing wrong with Twitter or Amazon or any of these companies deplatforming or banning Trump. That is absolutely permissible under the First Amendment, and there is no violation there. But the broader question of whether this leads to a problem with our free speech values, whether both we, from the idea that we, in theory, want a marketplace of ideas that has all kinds of ideas, even those ideas that we might find objectionable, it certainly gives us pause in that regard. And then from the practical matter, as you discussed, which is one of the leading arguments for having a robust forum for free speech, is that we need to hear about hateful ideas, because if we don't hear about them, we can't counteract them with counter speech. We can't bring them to the attention of law enforcement. So there is an importance to having even hateful ideas be visible to the American public. And that's a social question that is a very difficult one to answer. But from a First Amendment legal perspective, Twitter and Parler are absolutely within their rights to stop the president's inciting speech.
Karen Greenberg, you're an expert on national security. What do these events online mean for our national security?
Yeah, so they mean a lot. And so there's a couple of things. One, I like that Ian referred to the fact that these ideas are out there, and therefore we know about them and can think about what to do about it as a society and as a government. But remember also that they were there as the evidentiary trail for the FBI to begin to pay attention to what was planned for the Capitol uprising last week. And so it can be a very important tool. I do want to just say one thing, though, which is that we're focusing on the symptom, which is the expression on different, Twitter, et cetera, and not the cause. The underlying reality that there are individuals with violent aims who would take over the Capitol, threaten people's lives, et cetera, is one that we really have to deal with as a society. So it's the good and the bad. It's important to know that it's out there. And much as we can talk about how we deal with the internet itself and free speech, what we really have to think about is how to deal with this underlying expression of hatred and the urge to violence.
Which has become a threat to national security?
Absolutely. Yes, it's a threat to our national security. You know, we tend, because of the explosion of the use of national security after 9/11, to think of national security as something imposed from without. And what experts inside law enforcement and inside Homeland Security and elsewhere have been saying for the past year, very vocally, is it is a problem. The violence inside the country is much more of a concern than from outside. That doesn't mean that, you know, international terrorism isn't also something to pay attention to. But right now, front and center, our national security concern comes from within.
Karen Greenberg, our guest, historian, professor, and author, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, and she is also the host of the Vital Interest podcast. Also joining us, Ian Rosenberg, who is legal counsel for ABC News, and we welcome you as well about what's next and what to expect at 1-800-642-1234. Ian, I was fascinated to watch how NPR and our own WPR last week tried to figure out the best words to use about what was unfolding in the Capitol, and I'd wonder from your perspective at ABC News, what the discussions were like about what words to use about who was doing what and how to define that.
Well, I can't get into the internal discussions of ABC News, but I do think that one of the key free speech issues that we need to be thinking about in reaction to the Capitol attack is how vital the First Amendment protections of a free press are. There is so much discussion and criticism of the free press from both the right and the left. The right that the media is biased, and the left that it's not aggressive enough in reporting. But I think that what we can all agree on, and what we should all agree on, is that there's no way in which our democracy can continue, particularly at this moment where President-elect Biden calls our democracy is fragile, and brings up that point. This fragile democracy that is ours and that we are living in this current moment can only be sustained by a clear and aggressive and present press.
As we create that umbrella for a free press, within that umbrella can also enter misinformation, disinformation, and outright propaganda, posing as the free press. And it becomes exponentially difficult with an overwhelming amount of information to try to suss out what's real and what's to be dismissed. And when it comes to media consumption, Ian, how am I to even divine what is real when you have thousands of folks who are claiming they see smoke at the Capitol and are going to put out a fire?
Right. Well, you know, one of your callers brought up what she read on Facebook, and I think actually it was an example of much of what she read happened to be true. But, you know, I think that there are certainly so many problems with social media, but we do need to remember that at every stage of our media transformation in American history, from, you know, newspapers to radio to television, we are always told that this new medium is uncontrollable. This new medium is different. This new medium has less of an attention span, less focus on accuracy. And social media does, in fact, have these problems, just as all of our past media's forms had problems. But the fact that the media is imperfect doesn't mean that necessarily we should take a new approach to restricting social media. I think that what we have to do as good consumers of information is all the things that good reporters do. We have to look for multiple sources, we have to look for credible sources, and we have to try and suss out whether there's any bias or reason to disbelieve what's coming from an individual speaker. So all the things that make excellent reporters should make excellent consumers of media as well.
Ian Rosenberg, our other guest, Karen Greenberg, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Joe and Muscaday, you're on The Morning Show. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, sir. What do you have?
Well, my question is that I understand that what people have done, the violence is terrible, but my question is there's been violence, or not, I shouldn't say violence, there's been this hatred thrown on both sides of the aisle. You know, a lot of the Republicans have been called a bucket of deplorables and things like that. How do we move forward and get past those things?
Well, that would be a $1 million question, Joe, and I appreciate you asking it, and I'm not certain there is any silver bullet, but what sort of buckshot would we be looking at, Karen?
Accountability. We've, and I think this came up a little
maybe earlier, there is a silver bullet.
Yeah, there is. We've gone out of our way as a country not to hold people in government accountable for what they've done that is in violation of law and the Constitution and the rule of law generally. And it has to stop. And it's just been, you know, even President Obama, let's look forward, not backwards, for what happened in the war on terror. There's a sense that there's something wrong with holding very high officials, including the president, accountable. That's just not right. We're arresting and charging hundreds of people for the Capitol insurrection, and yet we're not holding the person who said, let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, I love you, accountable. That can't happen. There has to be a sense of accountability. That's why we have laws. They need to be applied, and they need to be applied in a way that is not overzealous, but that is functional and that allows us to go forward. And without it, I don't see a turn in the road. I see it just sort of like, let's bury things and pretend we can move on. Can I just tag on to something you asked Ian about before very quickly about language?
Yeah.
The fact that we don't actually agree on the language for what happened on January 6th is immensely important to us as a society. We're calling it January 6th. That's really not good enough. You know, the issues of what should we call it, terrorism? Should we call it insurrection? Should we call it a riot? It can be all of these things. They're not mutually exclusive. But we do need to understand that this was a violent criminal act that took place. I would choose the word insurrection. But the idea of running away from what it is and sort of that pairs away the suggestion of legal remedy for it, right? Because we're not picking a word, is very disturbing. And I think speaks to this question of how we go forward in accountability and accountability for what, which is why the grounds of the impeachment are very important, incitement to violence.
Accountability. John from Illinois emailed to say that he wonders whether or not the president would be able to pardon the rioters who stormed the Capitol and himself before walking out of the White House on January 20th. What do we know about the potential for pardons and how that could pave the way for relieving accountability going forward? Karen?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I did a piece for the Washington Post on this like weeks and weeks and weeks ago. So I wonder if I would still say the same thing. But yes, he can pardon them in a blanket pardon. That's been done before by presidents in terms of Vietnam War protesters and others. That can happen. Whether or not he could pardon himself, there are different legal opinions. I would say no, that very much a pardon is a transactional thing. It has to be given by one person to another person, and that you can't give it to yourself. That doesn't mean he won't try. And I would expect that he might try. Of course, it doesn't apply to the cases we mentioned earlier in the conversation, the cases in state and local courts. And so it can only apply, you know, and it doesn't apply for impeachment, which is another reason that going forward with impeachment is so important, even if it's after, you know, if it's delayed, maybe not 100 days, as some have suggested, but delayed beyond the immediate inauguration and appointments process.
Karen Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, an international studies fellow at New America and a permanent member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She's joined by Ian Rosenberg, who's legal counsel for ABC News and professor of media law at Brooklyn College. And they continue with our conversation as we tackle the question of what's next. You're invited to continue with us at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Domestic terrorists. That's how President-elect Biden referred to those involved in the insurrection last week. He also said that he would make passing domestic terrorism legislation a priority of his new administration. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and Joe Biden's support for this legislation is nothing new. Critics warn of new government overreach and erosion of civil liberties while reminding the next president of his 1994 crime bill and its unintended consequences of communities of color. So, what we've been tackling this hour, what's next? If this darn democracy is worth preserving, then what should be our next step forward? I'd be still open to you at 1-800-642-1234. Experts Ian Rosenberg, legal counsel for ABC News, Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. And so, Ian, if this darn democracy is worth preserving, what are you watching for next? With the windows being boarded up again here at the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, what can we expect?
Well, I think that we are certainly at a moment in our culture where all sides of the political spectrum are demanding their right to speak and be heard. And I think the thing that I am looking for is for a greater appreciation of our First Amendment free speech rights. One of the reasons I wrote the book, The Fight for Free Speech, is I think that while everyone has an opinion on free speech, we don't really know what free speech rights entail for most Americans, and we don't know how we got here. So I think before we can reform or change, whether it be Section 230 or social media speech or hate speech, we have to understand the rights that we have today. So really looking to history, I think, is the most important solution for how we go about charting our free speech future.
And let's go to Michael in Cambridge, who joins us this morning on The Morning Show. Michael, hello.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I have a question about the opposite of the coin, opposite side of the coin of you don't yell fire when there isn't any. And that is, wouldn't it and shouldn't it be just as illegal to say, for example, a country has a pandemic, a world has a pandemic, and a leader knowingly lies to the people saying, there's no issue here. People aren't going to really get sick. Nobody's going to die. It's like the flu. It'll be over by Easter. All these lies that have caused thousands of lives. Isn't that the opposite or the other side of the same coin?
And Ian, as you look to protect free speech, where does this fall under that umbrella, if at all?
Well, the Supreme Court has actually held that lies are protected speech, as counterintuitive as that may be. And I think on the one hand, we may be very troubled by it, and you certainly point out excellent examples of lies that have caused real harm in this country. But the other question that we have to then ask is, if we are going to start making lying illegal, who decides? And I think for a long time, there was a lot of feeling on the left that the federal government needs to jump in and start regulating speech to protect minorities and other disenfranchised groups. But who decides? And do we want, would we have wanted the Trump administration to be in charge of deciding what is or is not a lie? Would we have wanted the Trump administration to be regulating speech about the pandemic? I think the clear answer to that is no. So while I respect the caller's concern, I don't think that the solution is regulating speech.
Karen Greenberg, with the president-elect giving his support, at least vocally, to a domestic terrorism bill, does this promise to make us any safer going forward, or are there, and to what degree would this infringe on our civil liberties?
Yeah, it's a problem. The call for a domestic terrorism statute at the federal level has been growing over the past few years on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican. And it would give a name to what's happening now. It would criminalize it in a way that has vaster repercussions than we currently have. Civil libertarians, and myself included, are very worried about the overreach, because here's what's happening. We have a number of statutes, murder, et cetera, conspiracy to violence, conspiracy to murder, that can be used against individuals at the federal and state level who conspire to terrorism or bring about acts of terrorism. But what the laws after 9/11 criminalizing international terrorism did was to enhance the powers of surveillance and of looking at things like free speech and looking ahead of the crime in a preventive way, and sort of enhancing those powers in a way that, if you talk to criminal defense attorneys, they can give you, you know, dozens of examples, in a way that really did run over the constitutional protections of individuals. And so that's the question. These are for, you know, pre-criminal activity authorities on the part of law enforcement. And unless this is done very carefully, it's a prescription for a lot of trouble going forward in terms of not just the First Amendment, but the Fourth Amendment and more. So, I mean, that's the complex world we live in.
Ian, are you familiar with this legislation that the president-elect has endorsed and what it would do in terms of free speech?
I am not, but I do think that Karen raises absolutely the right concerns. You know, there is always line drawing when you get into discussing when speech should be limited, and that shouldn't be an intimidating factor for us in drawing necessary lines. But you know, I think the Brandenburg test, the incitement test, is a good one, that you should be able to advocate for even ideas that we hate. You should even be able to advocate for breaking the law. After all, the civil rights protesters from the 60s were advocating to peacefully advocating to break the segregationist laws of their day. But the difference is that once you start directing people to create imminent physical harm, that is where you need to draw the line. And it's a tough question, but a vital one.
And it's always a question. It's what we're always asking, is where we, our rights versus our protections. And Karen Greenberg, from a national security standpoint, with the FBI warning about the same extremism that we saw at the nation's capital to descending on all 50 state capitals next week prior to the president's inauguration, what's next?
Yeah, well, the first thing that's next is the country and law enforcement has to respond in a way that can protect the capitals and can protect the Capitol in Washington as well. It's extremely important message to be able to show the American people that without violence, that this can be managed. And that may be the most unfortunate downside of what we saw last week, was a complete collapse of law enforcement. So I would say that's the most important thing. Then going forward, I think there has to be some real discussion of adjudication of what information is important to know about, and how we know where the line is that reaches incitement to violence. And we have to be very careful about it as a nation. That is an essential part of keeping us safe in constitutionally protected ways.
Karen Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Karen is a historian, professor, and author, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law, an international studies fellow at New America, and she hosts the Vital Interest podcast. Ian Rosenberg, thank you so much to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Ian's legal counsel for ABC News and professor of media law at Brooklyn College. Most recent book, The Fight for Free Speech, 10 Cases That Define Our First Amendment Freedoms. By the way, you can hear coverage, live coverage from Washington as the House of Representatives debate President Trump's impeachment ongoing now on our NPR news and music stations and online at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer Kent today. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.